Do you have any possibility of getting away?
All right. Thanks to everybody making time for an EAC meeting on a chilly Thursday. So we're gonna move quick through like the administrative stuff. Just and I'm also told that this is our December 3rd EAC meeting. Just for the integrity of our record, we have guests here today. Just as a housekeeping item, I want to encourage everybody and just hold your questions to the end in the interest of time. We have some guests here with us in addition to our three presenters. We've got Jerry with us from the city's Environmental Sustainability Board. Mm-hmm. And we've got Larry, as always, and Mark from Mountain Trues with us.
Stacy,
thank you. I'm sorry, Stacy. I know your name. I just was on the tip of my tongue. So I'll entertain a motion for approval of our agenda. Did everybody get a copy?
Mm-hmm.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. So we'll get started. Again, we want to thank Chris, Steve, and Tim for spending some time with us. Just to kind of set the tone for what our intent is, we spent our first meeting of this term talking about what we're going to focus on as the Environmental Advisory Committee. And we came to consensus around two items. Those were water conservation, and so we had presenters two meetings ago around that topic. And then you all are representative of our other focus area, which is green infrastructure. Greenways, blueways, what have you, in Henderson County. So our goal is to hear from our three presenters in the areas that they're experts in, and then we can take that information and hopefully come to consensus on, well, how do we see the EAC helping to benefit the community of Henderson County? So without further ado, I want to welcome Chris Burns from Friends of the Coosa Trail up to give us his presentation.
Okay. And I think Rachel said it was better to go up here to the
podium. If you don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. Well, thank you guys for inviting me to come and speak to you. And I understand I have about 10 minutes, I guess, Rachel, to go over. So I'm going to try to run through as quickly as I can and give you an update on some of the latest, greatest happenings that are going with the proposed Coosa Trail. And then I'll entertain questions, I guess, at the end. But I'm going to make the assumption that everybody has seen the video, because that gives you quite a bit of information in terms of the where the trail is and what it consists of and its current state and that sort of thing. Everybody that I usually talk to at these things has some knowledge of it, and they want to know, well, what's the latest, greatest that's going on with it? There are a couple things that are happening right now that will have some pretty big impact as far as the potential of the trail go. Number one, Transylvania County, as most of you know, has formed a partnership for economic development, much like what we have here in Henderson County. In fact, Josh Hollingsley, who used to work for our partnership here, is the director up there. They have engaged in a study that one part of that is going to come back and try to answer the question, do we really have any potential of recruiting industry in Transylvania County that will need rail service? And we feel pretty confident to how that's going to come back. But that study is going to come back sometime in the January to March timeframe. That is something that we have talked to Watco, the existing owner of the Coosa line, to make sure that they're aware that study is coming out. And we've got a very good working relationship with the rail line. As a matter of fact, the other thing, this kind of news that's coming out, we are working with Watco to have some sort of an event in the spring that will probably be some sort of cleanup along that line. And that will actually be, we haven't scoped it completely. We've got a board retreat coming up in January where we'll do that, but it will likely be something that will be used as both a friend-raising opportunity and a opportunity to engage the public into coming out and helping to clean up some of the trash and the debris and whatnot that is formed along the line. And Watco does want to participate in that and is willing to give us permission to do that. So you'll see more information on that coming out in the spring. The other questions that we typically get are, well, what's this going to cost and what else is going on? And before I go into the cost piece of it, it kind of engages with that, is you may have seen that about a month ago, the Greenways and Pedestrian Division from DOT worked with us to actually get a portion of the Acosta Trail that actually starts over here by the Williams Center and goes to Laurel Park is actually now on DOT's long-term plan from a pedestrian greenways standpoint. They estimated funding for that section to be somewhere around $2 million, I believe. They actually pulled that funding number off of this document that you guys have, which is the planning and economic impact study that was completed about 2.5 years ago. At that time, these folks came up with a value of the line of about $3.7 million. The way that they came up with that value was to look at the value of adjacent land, which actually has, since this came out, been approved by the MAI, a group that actually oversees how appraisers do their work, as the way that you would appraise rail lines that are no longer in operation. So that's probably a pretty good number in terms of the fair market value of that line as it sits now. The second piece of that would work into that $2 million for that section has to do with how much it's going to cost to actually pull up the rail, pull up the cross ties, and put down whatever the surface is that would complete that trail. The folks that did this study suggested that asphalt would be the best surface to put down, so they used that in their planning, and they came up with that to be about $2 million for the total cost of that piece of the line. The consultants that we in the City of Hendersonville and DOT engaged a couple of years ago to do this study is a group by the name of Alta Greenways. They actually were responsible for doing the engineering work and building the Swamp Rabbit Trail. They built these trails all over the country. They actually estimated a cost of somewhere between about $500,000 per mile and $700,000 per mile to actually build out. And the reason for that varied amount is going to have to do with how many street crossings you have and how many trestles that you have to build up. I believe there are 14 trestles on this line, which would make it a beautiful trail when it's said and done, but it does make it a more expensive trail to actually build too, because you've got to get it elevated as opposed to just paving over the existing road.
So those trestles are over roads?
No, most of the trestles are over wetland areas. There is one that runs adjacent to and crosses the French Broad River near Horseshoe. That's the only actual river crossing, but there are some that cross creeks and cross low-lying areas, because once you get into Horseshoe, the trail starts running alongside of the French Broad River, which means that you're in floodplain for the most part. So, that's the majority of what's going on. So I'll entertain, hopefully stay within time, and entertain questions now.
Could you clarify that? Sure. The $2 million mm-hmm. dollars of DOT, and then you mentioned another $2 million?
No, the $2 million that DOT put in their plan was just for the purchase and the construction of the line from the Williams Center,
okay,
where it spurs off through Laurel Park.
Okay.
And they may have done some sort of future planning based on that being, 15, 20 years on the plan, too. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
So who's coming up with the money? The towns that it goes through, or state, or?
We don't know exactly. It could come. Our thought is it will come from a lot of varied sources. It'll come from private funds. It'll come from grants. It may come from some public funds. It may not have to come from any public funds. There are, if you look right now in Henderson County, the TDA is actually putting together 0.25% of the tourism occupancy tax toward construction of the trail. That amount should be about somewhere between $80,000 and $90,000 a year that they're starting to bank now. That would just be available for use in Henderson County. It would not be for Transylvania County. If they wanted to do something similar to that up there, they would have to do that up there. But so those are monies that are being put aside now. Interestingly, in conversations that we've had with North Carolina DOT, there is funding available that can cover up to 80% of the construction costs of something along these lines. So if you look at the monies that the TDA has already started putting in, depending on the time frame, you could have well over 10% of the proposed construction costs sitting bank and another 80% that are available. Honestly, any time that our group goes out and talks about a potential need for money, it is amazing the number of people that come in and the number of donations that come in. We saw that happen when this study was done. When the city council was working with DOT to fund this study, we felt like it was very, very important to have an economic impact piece that was included in this. That came back to cost about $40,000, $45,000 for that piece of it. The city had only budgeted about $10,000 to $15,000. So I went to Mayor Volk at the time and said, what would it take to make sure that that piece is in there? And she said, we need another $20,000. And I said, how long do we have to raise the money? And she said, well, if you could get it within the next couple of months. We raised it within a week and a half, just sending out emails to our email list. We've got about 2,500 people now in Henderson, Transylvania counties that are actively on our email list and respond to our e-blast. So, and that number grows monthly. We actually asked the folks that did that study that question, and their answer was, well, what else would you use it for? And one of the responses was, well, how much is it worth as a railroad? And their answer was, well, zero. You don't have any traffic on it. So it's could it be used for other things? Sure. What? That's kind of the question. Yeah.
Anybody else got questions?
Good questions. Go ahead.
Okay. When I was watching the film, they mentioned that some people originally had been against the trail because they were afraid of littering, this and that. And I lived in Colorado, and we had a wonderful neighborhood that all the streets were connected by walkways.
Sure.
And you could get anywhere. But there was a tendency to toss trash
over
the fence.
Sure.
Now, that could have been because the demographic was different, many times unescorted children. I acknowledge that the demographic is people that are trained to pack your trash out.
Sure. I would look at the two models that we look at when we're doing a lot of research and planning and talking about this are the Virginia Creeper, which is up in Abingdon, because a section of that trail that runs between Damascus and Abingdon is probably very similar to what this trail would look like. The section that runs from Whitetop down to Damascus is more mountainous terrain, a downhill. It's not as flat as what we're looking at here. So we look at that as an example, and we look at the Swamp Rabbit down in Traveler's Rest as an example. If you talk from a littering and a trash perspective, what they tell us is that, yes, there is some littering. People will drop a wrapper or throw a Coke bottle or whatever down. Most of how that is picked up is through volunteers. There are volunteers for both Abingdon and for the Swamp Rabbit, the Swamp Rabbit, that volunteer to walk and ride that trail every day just for that purpose. As a matter of fact, I thought something was really interesting. One of the volunteers actually put a couple of benches out on the Swamp Rabbit trail, and on it says, please throw your trash here. That way I don't have to walk very far to go pick it up. Very, very interesting, some of the things that pop up on those.
I saw a study of it may have been the French Broad, a river where there's a lot of rafting done, and people would toss beer cans. And they even had trash cans. Somebody got the bright idea to put a target behind the trash can and make it a thing. Target.
Yeah.
And it's just immediately people were using the trash.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Yeah. The other question that comes up is crime. Will this cause an increase in crime? And again, I think one of the best sources to look at that is to look down at the trail down in Traveler's Rest. So we have asked there are three deputies. Greenville, the county of Greenville, actually employs three deputies that are responsible for overseeing all of their trails and greenways in Greenville County. There is usually always one of them during daylight hours that is out on the Swamp Rabbit Trail. The other two are typically out in the other parks and greenways. But two of those deputies have actually patrolled the Swamp Rabbit since its inception. So I've talked to both of them. In fact, we've had them both up to Henderson County numerous times to talk with law enforcement here and to talk to other folks. And we asked them the question, tell us about crime on the trail. And really, it surprises me, but they make light of how little crime there is. They spend most of their time helping people up, bandaging knees from people that fall. They do, on occasion, have to write a ticket to a bicycler who is going beyond the 20-mile-per-hour speed limit that they put on the trail. The only two pieces of crime that he said that he can attribute to the trail, other than kids every now and then getting on the trail with a four-wheeler, in one instance, there was a couple of guys that pulled up to one of the businesses and loaded up a little bit of fencing in the back of their pickup truck, but they dropped off all the envelopes of their bills from their dashboard off on the trail, so that wasn't very hard for them to find. And the other one is a snow cone stand was broken into, they think, by some kids, and they stole some change out of the cash register, and that one's still unsolved. They haven't found those people yet. You do have the occasional break-in in a car in a parking lot where somebody's left their purse or their cell phone or their wallet or something in their car, and somebody will break in to take it. But most of the crime that you hear about regarding the Swamp Rabbit actually happens off of and away from the Swamp Rabbit Trail in the neighborhoods adjacent to it.
I know we lived for a while over on North Main Street and used that trail that went to Jackson Park frequently. Loved it. Iris. At the time when we were there was no crime. But people were talking about how wonderful it was that the police were patrolling as often as they were, because there used to be, it used to be scary to run there by yourself.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I think you'd see some of that with the Ocklawaha Trail now. I'll ride my bike down there. But, I'm careful if I'm riding it, if it's after dark or early in the morning. So, good questions.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Hopefully, I think a final question
okay.
for you.
Is
there anything that the government of Henderson County, the commissioners, are actively or passively doing to hinder the development of this trail? And further, is there anything that they could be doing to the opposite of hinder?
Mm-hmm. As far as hindering the trail, no. There's nothing that I can say that would be going on that they're doing or saying or whatever that would hinder the efforts of it. I think the biggest challenge that we have is how to fund it. You know, our county commissioners have a lot of infrastructure things, schools and whatnot, that are going to need to be funded over the next several years. And, how does trails or greenways in general fit into that? And our group, I know, is very, very cognizant of that and want to make sure that we make it as easy as we possibly can on them. And that's why we have never gone to our commissioners or city council, for that matter, and asked them for any money. If in the case of city council, when they needed funds, in fact, Bo Ferguson was actually the city manager here at the time, he said that in all of his years of city government, he had never seen a group that came to a council and said, we want to help you fund something and raise the funds for it. So, and we've kind of been that way all along. So, yes, ma'am.
What does Watco say about what they want
sure.
to do?
Mm-hmm. Watco is doing their due diligence now to see if the railroad is viable to be reopened. They have a marketing person who is assigned to the counties where their three lines operate, and she has actively and is still actively talking to businesses up and down the rail lines and all of those to see if there's any interest in having some rail traffic that would be enough to reopen that section of rail. It would take more than just one or two or three cars a week coming through there from their perspective to reopen it. So that's why looking at that, it's just very, very unlikely. If you look at Sierra Nevada is the last industry that we've recruited in Henderson County that needs rail service. At their peak capacity, now they're probably going to expand past where they thought peak capacity was, but at their peak capacity of what they had planned on, over the next, I believe, 10, 15 years, I can't remember how far out their outlook was, but at max capacity, they were planning on a need of 5 rail cars per week. So what some railroad experts have told us is that to open the line back up in Transylvania County or into Transylvania County, you'd probably need something along the lines of 20 cars per week. So, you know, all you need is 4 Sierra Nevadas.
And Chris, I guess
come up making an assumption that the funding question is not only to build the trail,
sure,
but also to maintain and manage it.
Yeah, as far as maintaining and managing the trail is concerned, that's a very good question. What are some of the costs that are associated with that? And we're trying to do some work now to pull some of those costs together. The challenge with that is if you go talk to folks like, say, in Abingdon or go talk to folks down in Greenville, Parks and Rec down in Greenville, the maintenance piece of it is such a small cost, they don't do a very good job of budgeting for it. So, for instance, Abingdon, you know, we've talked to Public Works up there and said, well, what does it cost you to do maintenance on the trail? Well, you know, in the summertime, we run a bush hog up and down it a couple times a week, and in the wintertime, we'll usually send a truck up and down it after a snow or ice storm to see if there's any limbs that have fallen on it. And they don't budget a whole lot for it. So, now, I think to be smart, you need to budget for things like asphalt repair down the road and bridge and trestle repair down the road. I know those are long-term expenses, but they need to be built in as you go along. But and then you've got some expenses along the lines of law enforcement. How much law enforcement do you want to have on the trail? Do you want to assign one officer specifically to that, or would one officer cover that in the Ocklawaha or something else? You know, those are questions that will need to be answered. And then the last question is, in terms of management, what do you actually do in terms of management? A model that we think works very well is exactly what Greenville has done, where Parks and Rec manages the trail. That may or may not work in this instance. The last piece of that is in terms of facilities, restrooms and parking areas and those sorts of things. And again, looking at the Swamp Rabbit, I think they've got a pretty good model for that. What they did, they went to the businesses that were along that trail, and they said, would you be willing to open up your parking lots and restrooms to people on the trail if we help to advertise that you open those up and advertise what it is that you do? So restaurants, convenience stores, and the like are who open their doors to folks on the trail. And they haven't built, I think they have finally built one public restroom on that trail. But for the first 3-4 years, there were no public restrooms. They simply used the parking lots and the infrastructure of the businesses. And the businesses love the idea. They expanded and boomed as a result of it.
There's a restroom at Furman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's actually on Furman. Furman built that. They built that for that park and that lake that's down there. Yeah, yep. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I don't know. Elevation.
Mm-hmm. The typical grade on a line like this is about 2%. I believe a handicap ramp is 8. There's engineers, you can probably tell me. But, yeah, so you're looking at an average grade of about 2%. So you're, what, 25% of what typical handicap ramps would be. And the reason that these rail lines follow those low-lying areas around rivers and creeks is because of that reason. It's typically less gradient. Yeah, typically what happens on those is groups like, say, Friends of the Acusta Trail. In Abingdon, you've got Friends of the Virginia Creeper, Friends of the Swamp Rabbit. They will typically organize volunteers that both act as cleanup for the trail and also work as workforce for the trail to build things like benches and those sorts of things. And that's typically how they get funded. So from the Swamp Rabbit standpoint, they went out and sought donors that would be willing to put their name on a plaque associated with a bench, and then they would put a bench up in that location.
Split rail fence, both sides of the trail, some psychological don't trespass.
The study that we've got here, actually, the price of this actually included in some areas where either businesses or residences were very, very close to the right-of-way or had been built very, very close to the line. It actually allowed for some construction of some high fencing that would, cover the folks that had those properties very, very close to the trail, both from trespassing and from seeing people that were walking or riding bicycles or strolling or whatever on the trail. Interestingly, we saw this both in Travelers Rest and in Abingdon. When the trail first came through, you saw some landowners that put up fencing or put up trees or bushes or shrubs or whatnot. Interestingly, if you walk or ride the Swamp Rabbit now, those are coming down. The people want to have that access to be able to get on and off. Same thing happened in Abingdon. They told us that there were a couple of retirement homes that were very, very close to, and I'm talking about assisted living facilities that were very, very close to the trail, and they put up fences that over the first couple of years actually took them down. A golf course, the Virginia Creeper runs right through the middle of a high-end golf course. The golf course took the fencing down, so it just opened it up to for people to get on and off.
Split rail, more psychological than...
Sure, sure, I don't know. But yeah, that's a possibility. But Mark?
I was going to say, I had two quick questions, but I think we need to move on to other presenters, too. So I don't want to, maybe we get answers in these emails.
I'm actually okay on time, so it's up to you guys. My game's got moved back.
Well, I think these address like some of the other issues with just other greenways besides sure. just this one. And maybe you said these slide information and process one time.
Absolutely.
One is, how's the ownership going to function on this? If we're looking at, because that's one of the questions with other greenways.
Sure.
Who's going to own it, who's the easement, and all that.
Sure.
The other thing is, I'm kind of curious about the phasing that's in here, because it's not linear. So I'm wondering if that's something that's commonly done that would want to be looked at in future projects and other
Sure. Let me answer the second question first. From a phasing standpoint, that is purely what that consultant came out and suggested. And the reason that they suggested it that way is so as you get into the middle parts of that trail, it was giving some access to greenways to folks in Horseshoe and Penrose and Etowah. Does it mean it has to be done that way? Absolutely not. So that's definitely a question for the future. In terms of the, what was your first one around property?
Yeah, who's going to own it?
Who's going to own it?
Hold the easements?
There's a lot of different models on how to do that. The model that I think would make the most sense would be to have each of the counties own the trail up to the county lines. From that standpoint, they then have the ability to control and operate as a linear park. They have the ability to control it. We have had conversations with some folks at the state level. The governor personally would love to make this a state rail trail. So if that were the case, it could be a park, a linear park that's managed and owned by the state. So there's a lot of different ownership structures that could take place. Is a temporary ownership structure. If for some reason the railroad came out tomorrow and say we're ready to let this thing go, and you know the counties could not react fast enough, we may put some sort of quasi group together at the state level that included members from the counties and the municipalities along the line and have it managed in that fashion until the counties or the state or whomever figured out the way that they'd like to hold it. So there's if you look at rail trails across the nation, there's just a lot of different models on who owns them, who operates them.
Do they mix and match?
Some do. Yeah. Abingdon, again, is fairly close to us because they span two counties and two municipalities, and Damascus actually contracts out with Abingdon to handle all of the maintenance for the trail because Damascus is so small, they don't have the really good capabilities to be able to do that. So there's a lot of different models that are out there. Good questions.
Is it just Friends of the Acusa Trail that are talking to the current rail owner and to negotiate that price and that sale, which would happen sometime in the future?
I can't answer that question directly. You'd have to probably ask Watco that. But, I know from time to time other folks contact them, for instance, the counties or the cities or whatever, just to keep up with them. I have to say they have been a very, very good business partner to us. They are very responsive. They bring us up to speed on a lot of things that they see happening. We make sure that they are not caught by surprise with anything. When Transylvania County decided to come out and do this study, we made sure we talked to them and let them know that was coming, because what happens in that study is going to have repercussions from them from a PR standpoint.
So I guess my question was, if Friends of the Acusa Trail had $3 million in the bank and they offered it to, what's the rail line owner's name?
Watco.
If they offered it to Watco and Friends of the Acusa Trail became the owner, could that happen?
Conceivably it could happen, yeah. That's not our plan, but it could happen. Yeah, we would rather have the state or the counties who are much better prepared to operate parks, to do something like that. But if it needed to happen from a temporary standpoint, could it? Yeah, it could.
Yeah, you just heard from you that Watco is the current critical path right now.
Correct.
And they own
correct.
It, and they're looking, still doing due diligence.
They're still doing due diligence. That is correct.
Something else.
That is correct.
So,
Yeah, and truthfully, from a when does this happen standpoint, Watco holds the cards. I mean, it's their asset. They have the ability to say yes or no to it.
And we have friends of the Coosa Trail, or whoever buys it, mm-hmm. has the ability to offer them a higher price to make it
sure you could.
Appealing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess technically, yes.
So that was my question. Like, is it Friends of the Coosa Trail offering them the money? But apparently it's this committee between Henderson, Transylvania, and City.
Yeah, it's actually, it has not gone to that point. If Watco were interested in letting the asset go, they would start having conversations that would then start bringing people to the table to start talking about making an offer for the line. Friends of the Coosa Trail has not gone to Watco and said, hey, we want to offer you X, or how much will it take? We haven't gone to that point.
Why not?
Well, because they're in their due diligence phase right now. We want to be respectful for that. I mean, if they found that there was a somebody looking at an industrial property in Transylvania County that was going to bring in 1,200 great high-paying jobs and they needed rail access for that, then by all means, reopen the line.
So they have a deadline on their due diligence period?
No. They've told us, you know, they've not put an exact deadline on it. What they have said is, you know, sometimes this takes 2, 3, 4, 5 years. They've owned it about a year.
Let's go ahead and...
Sure.
Hear Mark's question, and then we'll wrap up with Chris.
Could you just briefly cover kind of the relationship between the Greenville Hospital System and
sure.
the Swamp Rabbit Trail, and kind of what they offer, and if they're happy with the arrangement?
Sure. Greenville Hospital System approached the Swamp Rabbit Trail early on and said, we would like to significantly invest in the Swamp Rabbit Trail. So they initially agreed to invest $1 million into the Swamp Rabbit Trail. That $1 million could not be used for infrastructure. It was used for marketing and soft cost. They were so thrilled with the engagement that just about a year ago, they re-upped for another $1 million. So they will have plugged in $2 million to the trail, over the first 10 years of its existence. And it's from Greenville Hospital System standpoint, they look at it as a great partnership because, as we all know, hospitals and health organizations are now into how you do preventative health as opposed to responding. So, and that was exactly why Greenville Hospital System wanted to invest in that. And they told us, you know, tons of success stories from patients who have used that for rehab and other things that it makes a big difference. We've had conversations with the hospitals here, and they're very, very supportive and like the idea. We have not gone so far as to ask them how much money they would like to put into it because it's too early and too premature to do that. Sure. It was things like marketing the trail from a tourism standpoint, putting together the maps that you see. They hold some events that actually can be fundraisers for the Swamp Rabbit that could be used for hard costs. Those are the sorts of things that they put into it.
What about signage?
They do signage as well. Yeah. Yep.
I think that's a great segue to our next.
Okay. Thank you. Absolutely.
Very informative. We have Steve Smith is our next. You guys? Tim, unless you have a conflict.
No.
You good? Okay. So again, we got Steve Smith, Henderson County Director of Health, and we're going to hold our questions to the end because Steve is the local expert on this, and there's a lot, so we don't want to get him in the weeds early on because we may never get back out.
Let's not get carried away with the expert label. I do enjoy the topic, so I certainly appreciate you having me here today. And I essentially will answer the question why Greenville Health System, Hospital System, it's important for them to invest that kind of dollars in a trail, I think. I think you will be surprised maybe by some of the numbers or statistics that you're going to see. But I think what won't surprise you is that intuitively, I think everyone in this room probably understands that there's an inherent connection between opportunities for increased physical activity and improved health outcomes in any community. This was a little bit hard to organize. There's a lot of different little pieces of information. But we'll go through some of this just so you kind of get context, and then I think we can summarize that really quickly.
Can I see, or do you need me to turn off another light?
We can see.
Yeah, okay. Just a quick definition of public health that I try to share with people. I like using this because one of the things I like to emphasize is don't ever believe that public health is just what happens through the health department. We rely on lots of partners and systems to kind of execute that model throughout any community. This is just one kind of example graphic. What's interesting missing from here is something that's a really big shift with public health these days, and that is partnerships with planning, which is kind of what you're touching on today. So that kind of entity is not represented here, unfortunately. Some quotes from Greenways. You guys have probably seen most of these, but I thought some of these were certainly insightful. And I won't repeat those. I'll just let you read those real quick. And I'm going to assume you're a quick reader. And then just a couple more. So I think that kind of sets the stage for some of the things we're going to talk about. Just a shot of Greenways. This is a model which you can find on a website called countyhealthrankings.org. It was developed in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. This model is what public health and community health advocates are talking about. We've been talking about this for at least 5 years plus. And it's a paradigm shift for healthcare in this country. Before, I remember early in my career that we used to talk about access to care as the kind of century point for determining what people's health outcomes might be. And in this model, it shows that access to care and quality of care is really only 20% of that equation for improved health outcomes. We're paying a lot more attention these days, particularly to health behaviors and social and economic factors. And so you see up there in health behaviors, diet and exercise, social and economic factors, things like income, family and social support, and community safety. And all of those elements tie back in to discussions about greenways and physical activity opportunities. This is another metric or framework that I think is worth referencing. This was developed by Dr. Thomas Frieden with the CDC. He's the director there. He talks about the kinds of things that make an impact on health. So it's similar to that formal model, but a little bit different. But the bottom of the pyramid, the bigger foundation, those are things that have the larger impact on health. Again, healthcare has focused on the top of the pyramid in the past, clinical interventions and those kinds of things. Public health and others are trying to push that stuff down to the bottom now with a lot more effort there. That second tier of that pyramid has some really important language about making individuals' default decisions healthy. So not only do you have to have options for people, but they have to be easy options. Adult obesity rates, you've seen maps like these before. That, unfortunately, is the obesity rate, not just the overweight rate, but almost a third of adults in North Carolina obese. The general rule of thumb for me when I talk about obesity in North Carolina and this county is two-thirds of adults are overweight or obese, and one-third of children are overweight or obese. It's staggering. It's one of the biggest public health epidemics that we've dealt with in a lot of years. So certainly what we've been doing in the past isn't working. I think our rates back in the 1990s were something like 12%, then went to 20, and now we're at 30. We do see signs today that that's starting to level off. Poverty, going back to that population health model, is important in terms of just understanding people that might have access to physical space and greenways. I think it's worse than most people think about in Henderson County because we are blessed with so many resources, and certainly many people are well off. The percentage there for Henderson County is pretty small, but those that are at 100% of poverty level or below is 14%. That income level is extremely low. That's about $11,000 for a single individual. And I would defy anybody to try to survive on that. So most assistance programs today are set at 200 or 300% of federal poverty level because that's kind of a tipping point to a living wage kind of thing. So if you increase that poverty level threshold that you're talking about, then you usually get to a third of the residents of Henderson County. In many ways, when we talk about health outcomes here, we talk about the haves and the have-nots, and the realities for those two populations are very different in this county. Health insurance, just another metric. This is getting a little bit better, but 24.6% uninsured in 2013. So again, just one of those things that people don't have. This is from our community health assessment and shows the leading causes of death here, which are fairly in line with what you see with other communities in Western North Carolina. The reason I included this slide was to show you that there are often fairly significant disparities with those disease rates depending upon race. The 3 through 15 that's listed there, our counts are so low that they can't come up with a valid statistical rate. But as you can see with heart disease in particular, a dramatic difference in what some races experience compared to whites. Just the slide, again, from our community health assessment process that's being mapped out now is that, you know, we're not homogenous throughout the county and the geographic area. We certainly have very defined pockets where there are concentrations of ethnic and racial groups. So I think that's a consideration when you think about future locations of greenways in some of these spaces. To go back to the health disparities issues, it's no surprise that since you have concentrations of ethnicities in certain races, you have concentrations of disease in some of those same geographic areas. So we, of course, are interested in improving circumstances and equity considerations for those areas that have the greatest challenges. Adult diabetes, not too bad in Henderson County, but those rates are increasing, and that very closely parallels our experience with obesity and overweight statistics. This is one that'll make you think for a while. But just the cost of unhealthy lifestyles in North Carolina. And they've actually quantified what that means for various things from poor nutrition choices like low fruit and vegetable intake to excess weight, physical inactivity. And you can extrapolate those out to county level kinds of things. But we don't do a good job here, and the same is true in other states and counties, of moving upstream with more prevention-oriented activity. We're far more accustomed to treating disease and injury after it happens. That's a paradigm that we have to change. Attributable medical expenditures. This is in millions, so when you see that 2,000-something for North Carolina, you know, you're talking $2 billion, excuse me, for us in medical costs. Tenth, medical expenditures by Medicare and Medicaid populations. So you can see what those are. Know that when you see that, Medicaid-based and Medicare-based expenditures, if you're not on Medicaid or Medicare, don't kid yourself that you're not paying that cost. You are. You're also paying it with your own private insurance. We all bear that avoidable medical cost, the cost of that care. We're 10th in the country for attributable medical expenditures around obesity. So again, that's really big for us, $20 million. Public health, as you already know, is all about prevention. And so this continuum is helpful to understand, too. And when you think about open space, greenways, those kinds of things, those are to the far left in that primordial prevention category in the early stages of primary prevention. This is creating circumstances for people to be healthy, maintain health, and not develop disease or injury later down. Health impact assessments, I think, are one of the best ways to kind of consider the benefits of things like greenways. And so that's just kind of a quick definition of what they entail. And so the reference list that Rachel was kind enough to email out, the reference list, has got a lot of active links to some of these excerpts that I took out of there. So this kind of language is in every place. It talks about promoting health equity, mitigating health disparities, lots of impacts in terms of people that are willing to increase physical activity, particularly when they're more proximate to the trail. talks about social interaction, which is a big issue now in our country in healthcare discussions. In the 1980s, about 20% of adults stipulated that they experienced some degree of social isolation. And then that social isolation, in turn, had negative consequences for them now. That statistic is up to 40% now for adults. So it's dramatic. If you're not connected in some way to family or friends or a neighborhood or community or support group, you don't fare as well in terms of health outcomes. That's pretty well documented. Just some more excerpts from those. Let you read some of those. So here's some numbers in these two, which I found fascinating, and they're pretty consistent no matter which health impact assessment you look at. 55% in that top bullet are stipulated that they exercise more, which is a good thing. Most adults and most youth do not meet the daily physical activity recommendations in the United States, so that we need more exercise as a given. And then 70% for the bottom, for the Indiana Trail study. So these are just some kind of the summary elements that I saw in HIAs. You know, I think the big thing is that I saw consistently was that it improved access for physical activity, it improved the level of physical activity, and the end result or the ultimate outcome was that it reduced avoidable medical costs for all. So those things can definitely be quantified. In this bottom bullet, they actually went through a quantification and said that they estimated that it provided a per capita medical benefit of $564. It's medical costs that you don't have. So that's a very tangible thing. You could pair those kinds of things with estimates that Chris has for the use of a trail, and you could put a dollar value on that in terms of pairing that with other economic benefits like real estate values. And this I think you already kind of inherently know as well, is that it is a systemic problem. We have wonderful natural resources here in Henderson County with the forest, lots of areas, but those are not all accessible in the same way to all populations here. And so if we can improve access to physical activity opportunities, particularly for certain races, for certain geographic areas, for low-income families, that will have a monumental benefit for public health in Henderson County. The really tough thing to tell you about the health department and public health is if I took my entire budget and dedicated to something like greenway space, the reality is it would probably have more net benefit than what we're doing today. It's not easy to make that transition, but that thought occurs to me all the time. And that's the kind of thing that we're struggling with in public health. So those are the biggies. You've seen the references, and I know you're limited on time, but I'll take any questions if you have. Yes, ma'am?
What percentage of the people using, say, the swamp rabbit trail are minorities?
I don't know.
Is anybody?
What was the question?
What percentage of the people using the swamp rabbit trail, for example, are minorities? Are they using it?
Actually, Greenville has done a very good job. I don't know it off the top of my head, but if you go to the Greenville Parks and Rec website, they do a study every year to see what percentage of the trail users are minorities. And that information is on their site.
I would bet money it's probably very similar to the folks that use the parks as well. The parks in a geographic area seems reasonable to use the greenway just as you would the swing set.
But I think it would be influenced by the location of the greenway. If that's going through a minority neighborhood, I think the odds are very good that would certainly have a positive impact on their users.
The thought occurred to me that even if we provide, you know, a greenway going right through a neighborhood that needs it desperately, are people going to have time to use it, or are they working two jobs just to make ends meet,
yeah.
Which is why I'm very interested in that thinking.
Well, I think there are lots of layers to that question, but I think you have to rely on the fact that it's more accessible, that people don't have to take time to travel to some more distant location. It just improves the odds. Will it help everybody? Probably not.
Thank you.
But it starts to create a culture. You see your friend going walking, you see the family door next door going walking. You know, it has a multiplier effect over time.
They used to call courting walking out in Old England. Maybe we could revive that as an activity.
Will people generally take advantage of the health of, I mean, they understand the health effects enough to take advantage of it, or is there the extensive education that has to go take place for helping, you know, I mean?
I think promotion certainly goes along with development of these facilities, but I think people, it's just like I showed you those pictures of greenways. If you've got it in your backyard or just down the block, you'll be drawn there. You might not ever associate it with improved health outcomes at all. People like to get out. And, you know, some of our built environment just is not conducive to that today. I have lots of discussions with neighborhoods that talk about having very limited sidewalk access, or they're out in the country and there's really no place to walk unless they're in Farmer Brown's field. People tell me frequently they want more of this space. I think there's a question in our survey, Community Health Assessment Survey. It's a dramatic percentage of people want more of these types of spaces, and that's something I would certainly share.
So you don't have to go out and push it. People just get the health benefits by default.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'd rather be there right now than in this room.
See, one of the things that I've seen looking at literature about this is that it's not only used for recreation but as transportation. If I don't have a vehicle, if I can't get a bus line, I'm getting to work or to Ingalls or wherever.
Exactly.
Are you seeing that in the information that you're
Yes. Connected. You know, because it can greenway or trail can connect parks, can connect you to the grocery store that's down the road. I mean, there are a lot of people in this community that just don't have access to consistent transportation. So there are a lot of benefits to it.
I believe Village Community College, the number one reason for students dropping out is transportation.
When you think of Europe and everybody on their bicycles, they get there.
I've had people visit from overseas, and they come, and they're ready to get on the bus or everything. But so the bus takes them someplace, but then there's no way to get anywhere beyond that. No sidewalk or no way to convey to the next spot, so it's interesting.
Anyone else have any questions for Steve?
Thanks for your time.
All right, Tim, you're our cleanup.
Good.
Tim is our director of Parks and Recreation for Anderson County.
Well, good afternoon. Greenways actually kind of came up probably 23 years ago when I first started working for the county. And at that time, I was the outdoor recreation specialist. That was a grand title. I got to do all sorts of great things outdoors. But even back then, when I first moved to Henderson County, I saw a natural link between Jackson Park and Patton Park. And for the first several years of working for the county, everyone told me that's never going to happen because you have to go under. At the time was Four Seasons Boulevard, what is now Martin Luther King Boulevard. And because you had to go under it, that was the natural impediment. No one was ever going to walk under Four Seasons Boulevard. Luckily, that time has changed. You do have a map with you that kind of shows what is now the Okalawaha Greenway. And that was created in the 2000s, I mean, probably about 10, 15 years ago. And what that did was create a two-mile trail from Jackson Park, from the what was the former administrative office, down on what was the Mud Creek Nature Trail, which is now part of the Okalawaha Trail, and we go underneath Martin Luther King Boulevard, across 7th Avenue, and then follow all the way out to Patton Park. And that facility is about 2 miles long, so we have basically 4 miles there and back. It's heavily used, and one of the hardest things that I have to do is manage the issues that relate to flooding. So with all the rain that we've had most recently, there are sections of that trail that get flooded out, and the water table is so high right now that I can't move the mud and water because it has nowhere to go. So I can push it to the side and it just flows right back in. So just the nature of how that trail is located and the way it is, we're looking at ways to improve that. But what it does is it I have people constantly calling me and asking me, is it clear, is it ready? Because it's become such a part of what they do on a daily basis that when it impedes their physical activity, they let me know. So I have tractors that are ready when it's at a point where I can actually move the mud. We have that, we do that, we clear that out. We also get people that think that that 2 mile stretch is a very long way. So the first couple of times they might walk from our office, there's a little bit of downhill, exceeds ADA grade, but it is noted. So there is one hill, but then it goes downhill and it's flat all the way, and they might get to the Martin Luther King point and they turn around and come back. But what they find is quickly, once they cross 7th Avenue, it's not that far to get to Patton Park. And then they're quite happy to walk that 4 miles there and back. But then they come to me and they say, we want to go further. 4 miles is too easy. Whether it's biking, whether it's walking, whether it's running, that's just, I'm fitter than that. So, and that comes from people who really have had very sedentary lifestyles. So it's really encouraging to see that they would actually come out, they'll use this facility, and they improve their health. All of a sudden, either the doctor's told them to do it, they feel safe, and they're able to navigate from point A to point B. The exciting part is that the city of Hendersonville will be extending out the Greenway to Berkeley Park. So as you look on that map, probably about the 10 o'clock where the trail runs along Mud Creek, and then where it takes basically a sharp right-hand turn to the left, the trail will continue on up to Berkeley Park for about another mile or so. So that will extend the length of the trail. Now, also in that little bit of information, I have some stats that were done, some counters of when the trails are used. And obviously it's used in the morning time and in the afternoon time, and there's peak times on the weekends. My wife likes to go out and use the trail, but she doesn't like to go use it on the weekends because it's too crowded. So even for her perception of it's well used, but I mean, she wants to go out and she wants it to be longer so that it disperses the people so she doesn't feel so crowded along it. And that's what happens when you have a bit more room, but it also brings more people. But the good point about what that study does, it shows that there are people using it. And the exciting thing is that it's all times of the day that you can go out there and see people using it. I'll run on it, I'll ride my bicycle on it, I'm connecting from point A to point B, and it always amazes me the variety of, or the demographic groups that are out there using it. It's people running, it's people walking, it's people riding, it's people rolling. So sometimes on strollers, push chairs, and even some wheelchairs and stuff like that. So people are out using those facilities. We do have in the back as well, in the 2020 comprehensive plan, there are basically some lines or corridors. So there's natural areas where greenways might make sense. Again, it's the same way with the Acusta Trail. It tends to be the lower lying areas. Obviously, with the mountains, it's easier to navigate around the mountains and up and over them. So some of that information is basically some corridors, which is basically about connectivity, as Steve said, trying to get together areas between schools and neighborhoods and businesses. So that map was from 2020 comprehensive plan. Items are being addressed slowly as the opportunity arises. It's a little bit hard to see. They put all the lines in yellow on that map. But the exciting part as well is that we have the health impact assessment. We have Parks and Recreation Facility Needs Assessments. And even before I started working 23 years ago, they'd done an impact study, and one of the number one things they wanted was greenways and trails. We did one in 2007, and one of the bigger requests were greenways and trails, places to ride my bike, walk safely. So the need is definitely out there, and people are interested in. So not only does Henderson County work on greenways, City of Hendersonville does, and Town of Fletcher. With all their parks, they create walking areas. So in Fletcher, they have parts of greenways. And the exciting part is at some point, hopefully, they'll all connect, and that will give us a much larger network across the county. But the exciting thing about greenways is that the majority of our population can walk. If they can't walk, they can roll. And the ability to get outside and do stuff is a much greater appeal for someone who doesn't play baseball, who doesn't kick a soccer ball, who doesn't play golf, who doesn't play tennis, but just wants to go out and walk, they can do that on a greenway. They can still ride their bike, they can still rollerblade or skate, but just about everyone can walk and benefit from the greenway. Now, the other exciting part that we have is we have blueways as well in Henderson County. In other words, those are trails that are navigated by the river. We have the French Broad River that comes through our county, and we've done a good job with partnering with different organizations and groups. So we actually, it's not really shown on that map, but we have a put-in at Blantyre, which is at the Transylvania-Henderson County line. And then we have a boat ramp being built with the North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission at 64, basically right there at Cummings Cove, so that we'll have another access point. And then we have Mills River's kind of putting one in a little bit higher up on Mills River, but quickly runs into the French Broad. We have Westbelt Park on the other end of the county. So those facilities allow you to put in paddle, and it basically becomes a linear park in essence. The North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission has been very good about partnering with us. They have money that they invest in our infrastructure. We manage it. It allows access for sportsmen and for people who want to go out and fish and use the rivers. So it's worked out really well. We've had help from the donations and through work with Carolina Mountain Land Conservancy, and they've kind of helped acquire land. So a lot of these facilities have been put together with partnerships at minimal cost to the county. So really what's left for me to do is manage it, which really quite often is just driving by, making sure that there's not an awful lot of trash. And we tend to opt for the don't keep trash cans out there, so they don't dump their trash, so they take it with them. So what's left is really a few items to pick up. But it's always exciting to go out there and see the different people out there either fishing or out there boating, putting in, taking out. And if you actually take the time to talk to different people out there, their stories are quite interesting as to why they're out there. So we're excited to be able to have and expand that. I think having the French Broad River is just another great asset to go along with the greenways that we're slowly working towards. So. Is there anything in questions that I can possibly answer?
I think obviously there's a lot of good benefit. There's got to be some downsides to some negative besides just some of the trash pickup and stuff. And the mud, obviously.
That's a maintenance side.
What else is
kind of negative? I guess it costs money to build them, and if you didn't want to spend money on, I guess that'd be a potential negative. It does. I guess the more trails and stuff I have, the more staff eventually I need and some equipment to manage it. As the acreage that I manage increases, obviously it makes it more difficult for my limited staff. The fact that they operate 7 days a week, I have 5 maintenance staff, so it takes a little bit of juggling to make sure that 7 days are covered with 5. I guess that would be potential downside.
So staffing,
and it's not that it has to be staffed all the time, but when things do go wrong, if a tree falls down on the trail or when we have the mud, I do get calls and requests, you need to come and fix this right now because I'm walking on the trail and I need to get across. So it's not always immediate response to that, but we try very hard to get to it as soon as we can. I don't really see an awful lot of negatives, but that's just the way I think. I just think everything that gets people outside is a positive, engages them in healthy activities is definitely a positive.
I guess clean limbs and asphalt, long-term asphalt, all those are obvious. I was just wondering if there was something maybe that the average person didn't think about because they just for planning,
talking
about future ones, what would be good to look into and think about?
I think definitely trying to think about, so what happens with a lot of these is they become very popular, and when people start gravitating to them, then it's access to it. So you have to start providing infrastructure like the restrooms or convenience stations or parking areas so that people can access and park. The phenomena being that people will drive their car to become healthy. So really what you want is them to walk to it and be able to ride to it, but if they don't live adjacent or close to the trail, they're more apt to pack their bike in the car, put their strolling devices, drive to the facility, which then requires having either access points. So in the case of Jackson Park and the Diokolaha Greenway, it's great because we have all the parking facilities at the administrative office there. We have parking at the other end at Patton Park, and then we do have a small parking spot right there at 7th Avenue. So there are access points. But on some of the longer trails that you might see, as people want to move there and it becomes popular, on certain times I could see parking spaces being a little bit crowded and require either a little bit of planning or adding some infrastructure. But
Could you see, Autumn, this is kind of a planning related, could you see the Apple Country Transit expanding some of their drop-off and pick-up spots along some of the park or greenway areas if it were to, is that a potential option for connectivity?
It might be. It kind of depends where it is.
Parks having sort of master plan with the different parks showing different ways that connectivity could be achieved or how to connect.
We don't have a master plan. I definitely have a internal thoughts and plans of what would make sense between one parcel and another. Whether those are
there was a master plan that was put together several years ago.
Yeah, I think
it's already in one level.
Well, I know that the Apple Country Greenways Commission had one, I think, back in 2004, and went into the 2020 comprehensive plan, not really to see the light of day again. However, I just didn't know if Parks and Rec actually had a master plan and any bigger vision of parks needs.
Mm-hmm. You have a question, ma'am?
I walk my dog a lot. Fairly frequently. Do you find that the dog people are responsible or not?
I do, especially in those areas. So the people that are responsible are usually the ones that are walking on the trail. The ones that are less responsible, the ones that pull up to the parking lot, open the door to their car, and the dog jumps out, and then it's, we'll see what happens. Sometimes they're responsible about picking up their messes. Sometimes their dogs are friendly.
There
is a dog park actually along the greenway. So right there at 7th Avenue, the city has a dog park and a off-leash area. But the hardest part from my standpoint with that, and it's more of a hazard, is the dog owners that have the long retractable leashes that don't always understand the distance that their dog walks and the speed that I might be riding my bike or running or whatever else, and they don't retract, and it's always not always visible to see the clothesline that's going to basically either knock you off or trip you as a result. But you just have to be aware that think that way, that the dog is actually on a leash and there is a cord somewhere between the owner and the dog. So it does sometimes require a little jumping if you're not careful. But
they ought to have glow-in-the-dark leashes.
Yeah.
What vehicles are allowed? Are skateboards allowed? I know putting in that skateboard park was a big thing.
We don't have, the only vehicles that we kind of restrict, it's not for motorized vehicles except for the maintenance vehicles that we do use and the patrol vehicles that do go down there. So the sheriff's department do have some off-road vehicles that occasionally they'll ride down. The motorbike patrols, whether it should be the city or the county, do occasionally patrol them. They'll walk and they'll bike them too. So, that's one of those questions is we haven't addressed it because where are we going to get into with electric bicycles?
I'm thinking tricycles for the elderly.
They do. Well, we actually have
Segways. Something or other.
There are some laws that allow them to do that, so we can't ban them for mobility purposes. But we do have a gentleman that has a hand cycle that we've made a few provisions where it was a little bit rough. But he does ride his hand cycle from Jackson Park to Patton Park and back. he likes the warmer weather. He's not as inclined to bundle up with all his clothing and get out and do it. But,
I didn't hear about whether skateboards were allowed.
No, they are. I mean, so it's any rolling device. I mean, so they don't do it that often. There's one section they do at Jackson Park, but they use it as a longboarding thing because it's slightly downhill. So they use it kind of as a, they surf down it, and then they get their skateboard and they walk all the way back up the hill. So I think it's great exercise because it's, I mean, they ride down and walk back up. But we haven't had any conflict issues. They're pretty respectful. And the kids that like doing the tricks and stuff are gravitating towards the skate park at Patton Park. Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Yeah, great. So now the question goes back to, what do we do with all this great information we've learned from our presenters over the past few months, which is probably a $20,000 unsung question. And remember, going back to where we started, we wanted to find consensus around things that we could help the community, including the commissioners, so they don't have to get in the weeds on all the issues, only the big ones, right? That's kind of the idea of government in general. I want to raise up our earlier success, and it's a shared success. It wasn't just the EAC, it wasn't just the ESB from the city, but the B City. And we've had some progress around that. We are one of the newest B cities, and I think that's a shared success for everybody. So we want to try to work on things that one are in our purview, but also things that we can legitimately help with. You know, there's some things that are kind of out of our scope, out of our ability, I guess, in some ways. So I'm curious, does anyone have any aha moments from the presenters we heard today that, you know, hey, this is something we could help with? Is there anything that's kind of come to light after the three presentations today?
No, all good.
Well, in what we said at our last meeting is there were so many individuals in our community, the city, the county, working on water conservation. That, not to say that all bases were covered, but in large part, we felt like they were. Mm-hmm. So we're still trying to narrow down our focus to something that we could work on. And that's not to say that maybe there's not anything we can work on in green infrastructure, but I would like to also bring our attention back to what we talked about at the last meeting, that the commissioners have authorized research, not a formal study, but just research in general from the planning department. And John Mitchell spoke with us last month and said, well, yeah, we're doing an it's not a feasibility study, it's just, you know, just looking into things. So what we may do is if they're at a point to share some information with us next month, maybe we invite John Mitchell to say, okay, here's where we are, because obviously we don't want to duplicate information. Or
that would be my pleasure to do that.
Is that okay, John?
Certainly.
Because we don't want to duplicate any efforts, we don't want to try to usurp what the planning board might be working on. We want to help. That's the bottom line. I think my takeaway from today is that the environment is not just trees and forests and water; it's everything, right? And it benefits in all shapes and sizes. So is everyone okay with that? We invite John back to see us next month and share his insights with us. All right, John, we'll put you on the calendar. The other thing we wanted to talk about that Rachel and I talked about 2 weeks ago was meeting notes. So, let's say if you miss a meeting, how do you get caught up to the next meeting? You know, oftentimes in a situation like this, there's minutes that you can reflect on, and then minutes that folks who were present can say, hey, you know, Pam was there, but Ryan wasn't, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. So do we as a committee think that would be useful to us?
Please.
And the other thing,
I thought that was the purpose of the recording.
Well, and it's kind of part and parcel, because here's the other thing. If you miss a meeting, are you listening to the recordings? You know, the recordings are great because you get everything, but is it an easy tool to refer back to? Because it may be something where I've been to every meeting, but I want to look back in August. What did we talk about?
Yeah.
You know, be able to bring it forward. And it's not always the easiest with audio recording because we've had trouble with, am I talking close enough? Am I talking loud enough? Is everyone heard? Do we have guests here? Can their questions be heard? So if you're listening to an audio recording, can you get the full context, the full content of that meeting?
And do you need to spend an hour and a half to find out who spoke at that meeting? When I first started out as a reporter, I thought I'll record things and then I'll go back and write them up. And I found I'm on a deadline. I don't have time to listen to something for 4 hours to find out one little nugget of information.
Right. So that brings up two questions. One, do you want to continue? Rachel, I don't know if do we have to continue recording if we say, you know, written minutes are our preference? Is there
we do have to have the recording, don't we?
You can go back, I think, to the official minutes, hold on what was in the bylaws,
okay.
And get to that initially.
Yeah.
You can do it in either or. They'll have an official something of the meeting and then the voting on
official record.
Approved minutes, which you don't have.
Okay.
From a staff perspective, it might be best mm-hmm. if there was a member of your board that could maybe, because the fundamental issue with the minutes is the same as the fundamental issue with recording. You know, are you going to spend 20 to 30 minutes reading through what everyone has to say? It might be best for there to be like a one-pager that someone on this board would try and put the high points together. Some other boards that we work with will do like a three bullet point, this happened, this happened, and this happened. That keeps you from having to get into Robert's Rules of Order. It keeps us from having to maintain a hard copy log. It's just in the interest of expediency.
That's good advice, John.
Automated suggestion to me last year, which I've been trying to do, is to just do the meeting summary, and that's what I send you, and I just put who's in attendance. But I'm only, I guess, required necessarily to put what your votes are going to be. So I think the larger point that Ryan is trying to make is, should you miss a meeting and you don't have access to listen to the recording, there's absolutely zero context in this. So if someone wanted to jot down some notes and put them in bullet point format to send to me to add into this, we can do it that way, and that's very simple. But there's absolutely zero context. And since these are all public record, if I have somebody call and wants more information on number 4, part AI, I can't really give them a whole lot except the recording. So it's up to you guys, but...
It says we have a secretary here in our bylaws.
You can have a secretary, yeah. You just have to vote for someone.
And one thing that I think about in conversations like this is it can be a way to build bench strength, leadership. You could have someone say, hey, I'll take minutes this year, and I'd like to be considered for the chairman next year, the chairperson, whatever it is. Just something to think about. Sometimes, I'm not trying to make us too formal, but sometimes some formalities can help produce chaos. Not that we have chaos.
I'm a Robert's Rules fan. I mean, they developed because that's the way to run meetings.
So, do y'all want to have a vote on what we'd like to do as a committee? We've got 8 of 9.
I make a motion that we elect a secretary. Now we get to twist arms and get some
secretary.
Let's go ahead.
Are we looking at doing? I think I agree with John. I think that we keep the recordings as the official records so that nobody's bound up with being themselves, either staff or us. And then we just have somebody do informal notes, volunteer to do informal notes. Less pressure on the person, less pressure on everybody. And then we still have the official record that can be gone back to.
Okay. So is that a motion?
Yes.
I have two different motions. One for a secretary and formalized minutes, and another for informal.
I'm not saying 5 pages of minutes. I'm saying exactly what he's saying.
Okay.
But that we acknowledge the person who's doing it. That's a lot of work.
It is. Good question.
I don't think either motion got a second.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. If I
there on the table. I'll second yours.
Okay. Well, then yours could die for
mine
the second.
Mine's dead, lying on the table.
Okay, wait. I have to write this part down. You got rid of your motion?
Yeah, mine died. Nobody
okay. So keep, Chris, I'm sorry, you said keep the recording as the formal record and have supplemental informal notes.
Yes.
Okay.
Would you be willing to continue doing that, or do we need to?
Well, I am. It's just like I mentioned.
I'll volunteer.
There's just zero context.
But I'll do it as a volunteer, not as like an official secretary kind of position.
Okay.
And then that way we have the official record. You're off the hook for being required to add any more responsibility since you're already busy today. And it'll be taken care of, and we can work together to make sure.
Okay. So no seconds and voting. Okay. Hold on, that was cute. Okay. So she seconded that motion. So.
All right.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Nays.
Thank you.
All right, good job, guys. Now the last order of business, I guess I would say, for discussion is meeting frequency. A year ago, we were doing a bi-monthly meeting, and we just.
I thought we passed
those. Did we have a vote last year?
I thought we did.
I couldn't remember if we were going to wait to hear.
Yeah,
from
I mean, it's yeah. Fine. I remember doing it as just one time to see how it went.
Hang on.
Is that what it was?
Hang on.
We need you to listen to all the recordings
recording
right now.
I didn't
see.
So, hang on a second.
But I'm
not.
Yeah, we can do it again.
Can we just vote to change
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I'm totally fine with
you
that.
You voted back in October to have a November and December meeting to follow up on your speakers.
Yeah.
And then you already... And then you hadn't decided on whether or not you wanted to have the January meeting to finalize discussions from this meeting, because technically this is your regularly scheduled bi-monthly meeting. You added your November and September meeting because you were in between all these discussions. So technically you have been meeting consecutively for the last 5 months, when technically you should have only met twice, according to how your original bylaws were set up. So... The vote would need to be, do you want to continue to meet monthly, or do you want to go back to every other month, meaning that you wouldn't meet again from now until February. So that's where you are. Thank you.
I know my motions are doomed to die, but I make a motion that it's every other month. No second?
No, I vote for every month.
Okay, you make the every month.
I'm not making a counteractive motion
of
her again.
Rachel, you said a lot of stuff and confused me.
Okay,
so what are we on
so
right now?
December is technically your formally scheduled bi-monthly meeting.
Sorry, what are we doing as of now in the future?
That's what you need to decide on.
So we don't have a default to every other month?
Yes.
We do?
Yes.
So that's what we are.
Yeah.
So
right.
Let's just make motions if we want to increase that on a month-by-month basis.
Right.
That's what you need to vote on,
exactly.
Yes. That's
but we don't need to vote on it. All we need to vote on now is if we want to have one next month.
Right. Well, yeah. If we want to go to a monthly meeting instead of meeting.
So let's just vote on it. I make a motion to have a meeting, next month. Further.
I'll wait for hers saying monthly.
Okay, hold on.
It's the same thing.
No.
One's you up every time, and the other is we're coming every time.
I guess. So.
What if y'all decided to meet monthly until you have a better definition of your project and the project loads and what you're trying to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
And then you might not need to meet every month, but until then, it will help you distill out the process.
That's kind of how we got to the five meetings we've had so far this year. So
well,
I continue on that until we reach our.
It seems
we
to
just
me
vote every meeting.
You should meet next month, even though I won't be here. Because otherwise, we're kind of in the middle of things.
That's true. Yeah.
And we need to.
Okay, so go with meeting next month is what I heard Philip say.
I made a motion to meet next month.
And a second?
Okay, I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 So what date?
That would be January 7th.
And then you technically, because of your bylaws, have to meet in February unless in January you decide you don't want to meet.
That's right.
And you want to change your schedule. Which you can do, it's just I have to be able to give the clerk so many days' notice to post it online because it's a public meeting.
Gotcha.
So that's really where this comes down to.
And do we have any announcements besides the holiday recycling?
I do have one more composting event tomorrow to take the rest, the last of the pumpkins that are hanging out that haven't been given to the animals in the woods yet. So I'll be at Jackson Park tomorrow from 9 to 6. Jerry is going to be bringing me a bunch of gourds.
No.
And pumpkins, yeah.
Good, and I will selfishly bring my own pumpkins to make the pile look bigger. But
7 boxes.
Ooh,
thank
nice.
You. And we're also doing a canned food drive for Mana Food Bank, so if you don't have any pumpkins but you'd like to bring some canned goods, I'll be taking those all day long. So that's the last composting event this year. I'm going to try and make it a better, widely known event next year. And then I do have some posters on the table. Our holiday recycling campaign just launched yesterday. That's my poster. I only have 6 copies, but I can email you one. You're welcome to take them wherever you'd like. And I will have all the information on hcrecycles.org on Monday. I haven't had time to do that yet. But
you can't put it in your recycling bin?
No, that top left section is household or convenience center, and then just right under it is convenience center only. I'm trying
so
to...
this is household or...
okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's just there. Right
yeah.
there. Okay.
And then there will be the Christmas tree mulching event that's an annual event that Mountain True and the city and the county parks help to put on. I think it's January 9th. And then you can actually take old broken Christmas lights to the 4-H office at Cooperative Extension all year round, Monday through Friday. So you don't have to wait till the holiday. So you can take those over there as well. Those are all tomorrow.
All right. That sounds good.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations. We made it in less than 2 hours. Mm-hmm. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Dear, offered that motion.
It'll be until midnight.
All right, all in favor, let's get ourselves out of here.
Aye.
Good job.
All
right,
thanks,
you.
Guys. Thanks for sticking in with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy
summer. I'm going to go get my day upstairs.